Today's show is brought to you by Of A Kind, an online shop for emerging design. For more information, visit ofakind.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli. Thanks to Renny Lopez for those fun tunes. I guess you guys have been, in case you guys have been listening and have always wondered who plays those kind of rad tunes at the beginning, it's a friend of mine, Renny Lopez. Definitely check his music out. He's always playing around town. Today we have two friends of mine. Even more important, they've been friends of Heritage Radio Network, Leslie Pariseau and Talia Baiocchi, the girls behind Drink.
Punch.
The website is punchdrink.
Yep.
.com.
That's what's on your mind right now.
Yeah. I was looking up this morning and like punch. Why isn't this going? It's punchdrink.com. Yeah.
Hawaiian Punch owns Punch.
Yeah. We didn't want to try to fight with Hawaiian Punch to get punch.com. We're going to lose that battle for sure.
Yeah. They're gonna send a big guy in like a red costume.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like just staining
like
all
the
your clothes.
Kool-Aid Man.
So welcome to the show. It's great to have you here. I've been a fan since you guys just launched, but I think it's an outstanding publication. It's really a great mix of being approachable for everyone, but also having some really, really smart content, some beautiful high impact photography. It's just really, really well done. I think you're both doing a great job.
We try.
And tell us about how you met and how this project came to be.
So it's sort of a funny story, and it begins in France. So that's kind of fancy.
As all good things do.
And we were actually on a trip together to Bordeaux, and this was like we should probably find out like when this was.
I think it was three years ago.
And we met there. It was a really small trip, and it was kind of a weird trip. But you know, our friendship sort of grew out of that, and we hit it off. And while we were there, like, you know, a couple late nights in bars in Bordeaux, talking about one day sort of dreaming to do a website that brought together the worlds of spirits, cocktails, and wine. And we got back and we bought a URL. It was called anecdote.com. Mm-hmm. And with like, we had like $5 and we
and it went like, toward buying that URL.
Yeah. So we spent all of our money on the URL, godaddy.com. And then we like even looked into getting a web designer. We met with a few people, but the two of us were, you know, this was like earlier in our career, and both of us were just kind of hustling and like trying to make it and freelancing and busy, and it sort of fell to the wayside. And we still own the URL, and
it's funny. Every 6 months, renew anecdote.com.
And so the way that Punch happened, you know, when 10 Speed Press came to me and said, hey, like, do you want to do this this drinks website? We really feel like this section of the internet is sort of underserved. Immediately, obviously, Leslie came to mind. I said, I would love to do this, but I'm not going to do it without her. And so essentially, we are doing what we wanted to do 3 years ago, but with a real backer and more than $5.
So you met on this trip, and when you got back, and it was like an instant connection, and you got back, you're like, let's do this together.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we met. We didn't live far from each other, so we met up in bars and restaurants and talked about the idea, and met with a designer, but... Yeah. We were both hustling and trying to figure out the freelance game in New York, which is not always easy.
Yeah, I mean, you've both been published in many, many publications. You've already said so much, but Punch shows that you have so much more to say.
Yeah.
And I love how it's a combination of the archaic, mm-hmm. of what's going on right now and the mm-hmm. future and how things are mm-hmm. evolving.
Mm-hmm.
And let's talk first about the archaic, about mm-hmm. the old stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that, I know that both of you have history in art history.
Mm-hmm.
Is that where some of that comes from, where your interest in history and old-timey things?
Yeah, I think that looking through the lens of art is a really great way to see history. I think it's, for me anyways, when I was studying art, it was a more interesting way to figure out what history meant and the politics of a certain time. And seeing it through the visual, I think, is for me the best way that I learned. But I think for a lot of people, learning through drinking is probably more interesting than sticking your nose in a book all the time. So I think that's also, I think that is what's interesting to everybody, because almost everybody at some point in life is sitting at a bar or drinking at home. And so it's a really easy way to relate to topics that you might not necessarily come across. Mm-hmm. Like the other day, we published a piece about this guy who was an original member of the black metal scene in Oslo. And he ended up becoming a winemaker.
With Luca Roagna, of all people, in Piemonte. And you would think that this guy who's like about, like, you know, in the Oslo scene in the 1990s in terms of black metal was about like cannibalism and murder and like weird stuff, you know? And it's like doesn't really seem like a scene that would lend itself well to like, you know, fine wine production.
Yeah, and Luca is a pretty humble, sweet, soft-spoken guy.
But so is this guy, and I think it's such an interesting thing. But the piece was about the parallels between like what black metal really means to Norway specifically, and it being a reflection of that place being bleak and cold and sort of a depressing place. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in this sense, this guy, this musician, was expressing his place, like his land, like the music of his people, and is attracted to wine because of the same reason. So it's a really interesting parallel, and I think you see these connections sort of play out in different ways. And what we want to do is talk about them a little more, so it offers people a way to connect to the things we love in an easier way.
Yeah, and Leslie, you before starting Punch, you also worked for you worked in the spirits industry a little bit.
I did. Yeah, I worked on the education side for Pernod Ricard for a while. They started a program called Bar Smarts, which I helped to manage, and traveled all around the country with like Dale DeGroff and Dave Wunderich and Steve Olson, all these people who are so integral in building what the spirits industry is today. So sitting around a table with them late at night and talking about all of these stories that, you know, they've seen the spirits industry grow, and obviously some of them are in wine too. And it was one of those things that piqued my interest, because they're founding fathers. And so it made me want to go deeper. And I found that somewhat through the spirits industry, you know, sitting at a bar late at night, talking as a brand ambassador. But I was always pursuing at the same time writing. And it was just a really easy way to do it, because I was literally in the middle of all of it.
Mm-hmm. And how does that inform some of the stuff that you cover in the magazine? Like,
well, it's interesting now, because we're figuring out, we've been alive now for about three and a half months, and it's really funny. We're
like
seeing,
can't even feed ourselves yet. We're like infant stage.
but we're figuring out what our audience responds to, and it's really funny, because the wine side, everybody is very engaged on social media and kind of shows up whenever we have a wine piece. And we're still sort of figuring out the cocktail crowd, and I think that I'm trying to figure out right now, having been in the spirits industry, what they respond to. And actually, a lot of that is sort of the like weird historical stuff. Like, we had this piece from a bartender in San Francisco, Jen Collyou, and she wrote about the history of lime juice and the fact that lime juice before the 1920s was actually all key lime juice. And eventually the Persian lime, which we use today, ended up taking over, and that's what we use in bars and restaurants.
The flavor is so different. And
exactly.
So like all of these cocktails that we were trying to recreate from pre-1920 were totally tasted different. You know, like the daiquiri wasn't the same before then because of this lime juice. So, and people in the cocktail world tend to geek out about stuff like that.
They love stuff like that. Anything that's sort of recipe-based and informs the application of cocktails is interesting to them. So we're figuring out the balance of content right now.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. I mean, I think it would be really cool. I haven't seen anyone really try to replicate the old style of sugar.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh,
that
that's
kind
a great
of
point.
Like hard and dark sugar that was really prevalent. It's really refined white sugar that we make our simple syrups with. I mean, I guess if you use like a Demerara, it probably is closer to it, but that's still like way, way more refined than anything that people were using when they were like physically like cutting off pieces off of a sugar block.
Yeah. Like the sugar loaf.
The sugar loaf.
I know. There's something like really kind of gross, but also sounds delicious about sugar loaf. It's like a loaf of sugar.
Yeah.
But you know, it's funny about recreating old cocktails is like there's a place in, I mean, all of these ingredients that we're using now are totally different. So a lot of these brands have changed their recipes, you know, over the course of the last 100 years. So Dubonnet, for example, is completely different than it was, you know, in the beginning of the last century. And we did Leslie wrote a piece about this bar in Berlin that actually is sourcing, you know, all of these spirits from, you know, 100 years ago. So a lot of this is like 19th century old Tom gin and making cocktails from these, like actually from these bottles from them. So really, truly, literally recreating the cocktails. But most of what we're doing now is, you know, obviously not exactly the same as it was before. But and he would charge like, it was like $300 for a Sazerac or something.
€300 for a Sazerac. Yeah, it was €300 for a Sazerac. Every ingredient was like over 100 years old.
An annual salary in 1920.
Yeah, exactly.
And actually, Talia's been doing a lot of the same thing and testing sherry cocktails for her book, which I've been privy to the process and been able to sit around and test all of her drinks. But, you know, recipes were written in such a different way back then. And when it calls for sherry, there's no specification whether it's Amontillado or Oloroso. And so it's been kind of fun seeing her play with that process as well and being part of it.
Yeah, it's kind of fun.
And that's true. I mean, there's a culture now where people like to share what they do. They share their recipes. Mm-hmm. Everything is published. There's no more like secret formula. Like, I mean, you remember even like 15 years ago, it was all about like your secret formula.
Yeah.
But especially those early bartenders in the 19th century, I'm sure that they were much more secretive. They were like the Nona who like gives you every ingredient to her tomato sauce and leaves one out intentionally.
Yeah, like the guanciale, and you're like, how do you leave out the guanciale?
It was even like that in the tiki movement though, and I think we're sort of in some bars you still see that. Like I for the life of me cannot get that ginger syrup recipe from the Sasha Petrosky places, and I know that it's out there, but if you ask any of those guys directly, they're like, oh, sorry sweetie, I can't let you in on that. But I think that there still are certain things that are the signature of certain places like that people keep secret, and it keeps sort of the mystique of this industry as well.
And tell us about the what you see as evolving in the drinks world.
That's a good question. I mean, I think one thing that for me has attracted me to spirits is like seeing that you know, we're kind of reconsidering a lot of these things like mezcal and rum agricole and cognac, and understanding that they're agricultural products. And I think a lot of people when they think of spirits, they think of Jose Cuervo, they think of Bacardi, and there are those two things could not seem further from being an agricultural product. And I think there is sort of this kind of back to the land movement in spirits, and people are starting to see how not only do they impact the environment, but how they can reflect terroir. And so for me, I see the industry going forward in that way on the spirit side, just coming at it from a wine perspective.
I loved your mezcal piece, which had more pictures of the agave fields than it did of, you know, of the actual production of it.
Yeah, that was a great photographer couple that we work with, Pete and Monk, and we're actually working with them more. But they're super talented, and they ended up going to Jalisco, and I think it was actually tequila.
It was tequila,
but very similar tequila process, and they really captured it. And I think that's exactly what Talia's hitting on, that it's less about the bottling and what happens inside of a factory, but more about what's happening and being grown in the ground.
It's a really cool time, I think, and I think it's revolutionary for the spirits industry, and you know, I think it creates a lot of room for small artisanal people making really interesting spirits to like kind of really cut into that market share. So, look, Bacardi is always going to be Bacardi, and you know, Jose Cuervo is always going to be Jose Cuervo, but I think people are kind of looking in an opposite direction, which is really exciting.
Yeah.
I think that is exciting. Okay, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with more with Talia Baiocchi and Leslie Pariso from Punch. Check out their website, punchdrink.com, but we'll have some more of them in a little bit.
Listening to Snickers by Obesity on heritageradionetwork.org.
Interested in emerging design? Check out Of A Kind, a site that sells the pieces and tells the stories of up-and-coming makers. The site has featured over 200 designers and offers limited edition pieces you can't find anywhere else, along with the studio tours, travel guides, even recipes from the designers. To find out more, head to ofakind.com and sign up for the site's newsletter.
Back on In the Drink. I'm here with Tali Bayoki and Leslie Pariseau from Punch. Check them out at punchdrink.com. They were, during our break, they were telling me about a video segment on tonguing. And and I just love hearing about tonguing. Tell us about, what's tonguing all about?
It sounds dirty, but it's not.
No, it's not. It's it has to do with port. But port tonguing, which I recently found out about, this is an obscure wine practice, where it's a metal tong and they heat it up in the fire and then they put it over the neck of an old vintage port bottle. It's generally port. And it heats up, like it basically creates a ring that's really, really hot. And then, and Leslie just watched this happen, so she could.
And then they put a bit of, they brush a bit of ice water onto it, and I think the temperature difference allows the break, the a clean break. And then they dip each side of the bottle in wax so that when they pour it, there's no chance of shard. Yeah.
So you see this in no shardage in your time.
No shardage.
You see this in Portugal. I've seen it happen in Portugal, really only for very, very old vintage port, because vintage port, I think of any wine maybe, throws the most amount of sediment. Mm-hmm. So if you can like disturb that bottle as little as possible, that would be really preferable.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
So what got you interested in
tonguing?
Yeah.
No, I got an email from Sarah Rosenberg, who works with 11 Madison Park and the Nomad, and she, like, literally it was so cryptic. It was just like port tonguing. All she just said is port tonguing, and I was like, what is port tonguing? And so I went on YouTube and looked it up, and like the only video I found was this like super creepy guy who had like a pot belly and he was with his kid, and he was like demonstrating this whole process. And I was like, this is the weirdest thing I've ever seen. And everyone right now is obsessed, obviously, with sabering. It's like the new cool thing. And so I was like,
yeah,
is port tonguing?
Makes it look so good.
Yeah, he really
so
does.
Much fun.
But like, could port tonguing become the new sabering? And I think we're trying to answer that question. So getting to the bottom of this really important
thing. What's so interesting is that 11 Madison, obviously, it's one of those places you go for a dining experience. But they wheel this cart out, and they've got the whole setup there. But they actually do it, he said, up to like two or three times a night, which is funny, because I've never seen it anywhere else, and I don't think you have either. But they also do it for old bottles where the corks may be more disintegrated than others, so that they get a bit of flair while they're opening a bottle without breaking a cork.
There's like something like really like Victorian or whatever about like taking, like opening a bottle with like a hot iron. It's like really primitive.
In a dining room.
Yeah, in a dining room.
Yeah.
But everyone loves fire. So like if you can bring fire into anything, people just like their eyes go wide and they're just kind of like captivated.
Yeah.
That's why we light punch on fire.
So... you light the internet on fire.
No, we actually create flaming bowls of punch.
It's, we did a video. We did this obscure recipe. It was a recipe that was written by Charles Dickens, who was a great drinker of his time. And to caramelize all of the sugar, he set the spirits on fire before he added any of the juice or the tea or water or whatever you would use. And you let it sit there for 3 minutes, just flaming away.
Yeah.
And you did a video of this, and it's on the website?
Yeah, I did.
Do you recommend doing this at home?
Heat-proof bowl.
Carefully.
Heat-proof bowl, and have a pan to put over when you need to extinguish the flame, because you can't blow that out.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's blow it onto your guests. Yeah.
It becomes a flamethrower. Yeah.
I'm sure there's been a lot of mishaps with flaming bowls of punch in history, in the 300 years of punch making or whatever, but
Where did you come up with the name punch? Obviously, when in cocktail history, punches might be some of the oldest, the original way that people would drink. They would sort of all drink around the same punch bowl, and everyone would have the same sort of drink. Is that where it came from?
Kind of. I mean, there's a couple of different things that sort of inform the name. And one, I think this communal aspect of like coming together around a bowl of punch, like that being sort of symbolic of what we're trying to create, which is something that really people felt. A lot of different people could come to the place and feel comfortable on the site. And so that certain sense of community was certainly informed the name. And then also there was an old British magazine that was a literary magazine called Punch, and it's no longer, but it lasted for, probably on and off for 150 years. I mean, it was sort of the New Yorker of London. And so that sort of was also a little bit of a nod to that magazine. And it's hilarious, actually. Like it's very rarely that you sort of laugh out loud to something from like the 19th century, but like it's really funny.
All of the archives are online. You can go and find almost every single issue. And actually when we were designing our logo and our branding, we looked to a lot of the, they would change their logo actually relatively often. So we looked to a lot of those designs to inform our own design. Mm-hmm.
And before you launched, you released a little pamphlet, which I loved and have shared with our bartenders, and it's kind of floating around the group right now. Yeah. But I think it's really, really beautifully done and kind of hand bound. Mm-hmm. Do you plan on doing anything else that will be printed?
We have always had plans for print, and now that we are up and running and we've sort of established our voice and tone, I think we'll start looking to doing things like a quarterly or a biannual journal, something that feels like an object that you can keep on your shelf. And we'll probably create stories that, you know, you're better told in print than necessarily the web. Mm-hmm. Maybe some longer forms, definitely some of the photography that you've been seeing on the site and illustrations as well.
So do you think that it, sort of a longer story is better in print? Yeah. That would be the difference? Yeah.
Definitely. It's,
you know, when we think about how we sort of consume information on the web, most people are just kind of literally we're like on a crawl every day, and you're like stopping off and you're like taking like a little piece of information and moving on. And it's not often that you're spending like a ton of time on one website, like reading a bunch of stories. But when you're sitting at home and you have like this tangible thing, like you want to sit around and read or like have a drink while you're doing or drink your coffee and read a story. And that's why I think that in some ways everyone thinks, oh, the web is the future. But I think in some ways, like a lot of things that we would want to do, we can't do on the web.
And we're seeing a great revival right now of print journals, everything from Lucky Peach to Cherry Bomb. And I think that that's getting at something that people want. They want to hold something in their hands. And we're always going to be on the internet, but I think that there's always going to be a space for print as well, and we would love to be part of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hope you're right. There's been a void of good print journalism, especially when it comes to the drink industry.
I completely agree. Yeah, and you know, you go to a place, like you go to these small bookstores, or you go to, you know, for me, I go to the Meat Hook or Brooklyn Kitchen, and you see like this entire row of these incredible food journals, and there's not one thing on drinks. And it's sort of weird, and I think that's going to change for sure. I hope that more people get into that game and we start to see some really creative drink stuff. You see some of it from London, but nothing really here.
Yeah.
There's also a section on your site that is kind of newsy, more than these kind of stories are fun, newsy clips that are a little bit more current eventsy. How do you decide what to include for that?
Well, that part of our site is still very much evolving, but
they're really fun. Like MSNBC's Chuck Todd doesn't like American beer. And
yeah, it's, you know, it's stuff that we find while we're all day trolling on TweetDeck and constantly checking our inboxes for new press releases. But it's one of those things that we're sort of discerning something that would fit in with our tone normally. And we have a great intern that works with us who's been on a lot of the news too, and she's got a very natural voice, so she's been helping out. But yeah, it has to be current. It has to be the day of.
A lot of it is a bit silly for us because it's become a little bit of an outlet, and I think it's just like, you know, I think, you know, we're working on a lot of serious stories, but I think with the site, one thing that we both want to convey is that, like, we don't take ourselves too seriously, and you know, that this is fun. I mean, it's alcohol after all. And so there's a lot of, like, there is stuff about Bieber and, like...
There's a lot of Googling of celebrity drinking.
Yeah. Which is fun to read about. I mean, yeah. Come on, everyone wants to read about, so, like, the latest DUI from whoever.
who has kind of the worst celebrity drinking habits? And who
Dennis
has the
Rodman is really hot right now. Yeah. You know, the whole North Korea situation is pretty messy, and so... It's not good, but we've got our ears peaked for whenever he's about to show up. The Biebs.
Never-ending sort of source of ridiculousness.
I love this, that now that the White House has to make an official statement on whether or not to... Did you hear about
deport
this?
Deport him?
Whether or not to deport Justin Bieber.
I had not heard this.
So on whitehouse.gov, they basically have this section where anyone can submit a petition, and if they get 100,000 signatures on it, then the White House has to research it and make an official statement on it. And one of them was, should we deport Justin Bieber? Send him back to Canada. He's on this kind of entertainer's visa.
American society.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that that's, like, really something we should seriously consider.
Any celebrities have particularly excellent drinking habits that you know of?
Ooh, that's a great question. I've heard that Ashton Kutcher does.
Well, they were recently in the Mila Kunis and Ashton Kutcher were, like, they've been kind of, like, hopping around some cool wine regions. They were in Jerez drinking sherry during the Feria. Mm. And then were they recently, like...
I'm not up on my Us Weekly. No, but we do have, a constant piece that comes up every couple weeks, every 3 weeks, called Drinking With. And we've hit on some people, like we did Ari Shapiro from NPR, who is once the White House correspondent, has recently moved over to London. We did one with Nancy Wang from LCD Sound System, who has excellent taste in wine. Mm-hmm. So we're always looking for more of that. So if anyone has any suggestions, please do.
But, the, you know, musicians on the whole, like, a lot of the time you see, there's, like, this whole enclave of Brooklyn musicians that are really interested in wine, and specifically natural wine, which is really interesting. And then, obviously, you know, there is a budding interest in Barolo on the black metal side. But, like, there's a lot of musicians who are really interested in wine. In drinks in general. So, I hear that Drew Barrymore, even though, yes, she makes, like, a really not good Pinot Grigio, actually, like, is legitimately interested in wine. Yeah. But, you know.
And what stories that have not been released yet are you really excited for them to come out?
Ooh, that's a good question. I'm working on one right now that is not fully formed, but it talks about the intersection between tattoos and the spirits industry. Because there's this really odd marketing tactic. Mm-hmm. I guess it's not so odd anymore, but Sailor Jerry once or twice a year offers free tattoos for people. And it's genius marketing to permanently
actually
tattoo
brand a human.
Yes, exactly. But it's also such an odd thing, because usually tattoos are thought about as this thing that is sort of rebelling against the usual mores of society and, like, marking yourself with your individuality. Mm-hmm. And for people to buy into an actual brand and brand themselves is such an
odd thing.
It's really weird.
Yeah, and we're working, we have a beautiful photo essay that we're doing on the Meadowoods bar program, which is sort of, like, for lack of a better description, is sort of this, like, farm to drink. I hate that, but there's really no other way to say it. But they're utilizing all of these incredible ingredients on the property. And I think, you know, the West Coast cocktail, we did a story about how it's sort of kind of fallen off, and this idea of sourcing all of these California ingredients and making these amazing drinks. But it's sort of alive and well in wine country. And we just shot a beautiful kind of from the field all the way to the creation of the cocktail, which is super cool.
Yeah, I love how the publication has a great intersection of art, history, culture, agriculture, and what's going on right now. Beautiful photography. Both of your voices and other talented writers. You're doing a tremendous job. And
thank
so
you.
Thank you. Thanks, thank you, Joe. for adding this to the drinks world. We needed it. I hope that you're inspiring other people to do the same, because
yeah,
it's great.
Yeah.
And it's great. And thanks so much to everyone for listening. Just a little personal plug. We have recently, in the last few months, launched our catering company, Epicurean Events. And so if anyone Woo-hoo! Out there would like to throw a party or do a drop-off lunch catering for your very, very, very lucky office, give us a shout at epicurean-events.com and make sure you check out Punch. It's really outstanding, as I said. It's punchdrink.com. Talia and Leslie, thank you so much. And
thank you.
Thanks, you guys, for listening. It's been In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.